I'd like to do in this talk is to we'll extend a little bit and build on some of the issues that Ed Lewis talked about in the first one of the session. And so I'd like to start off by acknowledging the collaborators. As Ed mentioned in his talk, David Shapiro, Lon, and Ed and I have been involved in a project looking at these influences of being of a host being infected on subsequent infections. And then a lot of the work I'll talk today was done by a graduate student of mine, Janie Christen. So infection decisions, as was mentioned earlier, really deal with this question of when a potential host is encountered, should the parasite infect it? And you can sort of have two extreme examples. One would be to just always infect anything you encounter. And then the other would be to have some sort of fitness optimization strategy where you adjust whether to infect or not based on some measure of the quality of that host. And so there are a number of factors that will impact this question of what is host quality. And then the other thing I will focus on a bit more in this time is how can host quality be accurately evaluated? So do infective stages have reliable information on which to make decisions about whether that host varies in quality or not? So host quality can be a function of both the host species and the life stage, the size of the insect, its physiological status, basically tying into its ability to defend itself, and then also, as was mentioned earlier, its infection status. And so it could be infected by other pathogen groups or by the same species. And then focusing in on the same species, we could ask what's the effect of things like the density of that infection, the age distribution of individuals, the time after infection, and so on. And all of these things could come into play. And so in today's talk, I'm really going to focus in on just conspecific questions. And so assessing host quality can occur at a variety of different steps in that host finding and infecting process, beginning in habitat finding through host finding all the way to the establishment and the suitability of the host. And it's likely that there are multiple cues involved in this process, different cues, suites of cues involved at each step in finding, some that are both stimulatory and some that are inhibitory. But it's not really known, and I'll mention some of the cues that have been identified already, but it's not really known which of these are specifically involved in evaluating the quality of a host. So we'll focus on this talk on entomopathogenic nematodes and their associated bacteria. Some of this has already been covered earlier, but basically Steinertomatid and heterobdidid nematodes and their associated photorhabdus or xenorhabdus bacteria. And basically what we're looking at are these complex interactions between the nematode, the bacteria, and its host in terms of whether an infection occurs and whether it's successful. So the key players, obviously the nematode, and we've heard more about those, but I'll go over it a little bit. There's that one free-living life stage that actually seeks out and initiates the infection, and it vectors the bacteria between hosts. And then we can speculate a bit that, you know, field research has determined that there are patchy distributions of nematodes in the soil. This is likely to lead to encounters with already infected hosts at different points in the infection process. So we don't know the probability of this in the soil and how much it might vary, but it's likely that there are certainly situations where this is occurring. And then there's the symbiotic bacteria. It's a modal gram negative bacteria, produces toxins that aid it in the killing of the host. It also produces antibiotics that reduce competition within the host, and it modifies the host environment to facilitate nematode development and reproduction. And potentially it could be influencing these infection decision processes, like Ed mentioned earlier. You know, why do they prefer hosts at different life stages, at different stages in that infection process? Certainly the growth of the bacteria and the changing of the host due to the bacteria could be producing cues that are used in assessing hosts. And finally, there's the insect host. As I mentioned already, the different species and life stages could influence whether the fitness benefits of infecting that particular host. And it also impacted by the number of founders that are already in there. As mentioned, there's an allele effect, so there's certain benefits to having a certain optimal number of nematodes initiate an infection. And the hosts encountered in the soil are often patchy in distribution. So this suggests that it may be possible that IJs are in fact having multiple opportunities, may encounter hosts multiple times. So there may be more than one chance. If that's not the case, then we may end up with more of this infect anything you encounter type of strategy. Those hosts may already be infected and variation in the stage of infection. And so ultimately the risks of infecting needs to be weighed against the risks of passing on that infection, and what's the probability that you're going to have another chance to infect. So already infected hosts with conspecifics, Ed mentioned already in his talk, focusing in on this very early stages in the process where there's definitely advantages to coming into that host and getting established. What I'd like to focus on is much more long-term as we go out into here. What are the benefits or risks of infecting at those different time points? So certainly an uninfected host, depending on the species obviously, you're certainly dealing with potentially a higher risk of mortality during establishment, a higher risk of not finding mates in Steiner pneumatid species that are sexual. But you have a potentially a very high reproductive potential if you're successful and others go into that host as well. Early on in the infection, after it's already started, and that's where Ed was showing how that herding idea comes into play, you get all those benefits, but you lose a lot of the risk associated with the mortality during the infection process and failing to reproduce. And then once you get out into here, presumably that host would not be very favorable to infect. The nutrition's conditions are less favorable. You'll be out of sync with a lot of the other life stages that are cycling through, and so your reproductive success would be predicted to be lower. So if an IJ encounters a host, how is it able to tell the stage of that infection? There's been a number of things that have been identified, although really for many of these, there's very few specific compounds that we know influence infective stage behavior. Carbon dioxide was one of the first ones that has had a lot of work done, and it's been shown that they actively respond to that cue. Things in host excretory products, bacterial symbionts as a whole, have shown to function in terms of attraction or arrestant. pH, host exudates influence the behavior, and also contact cues. But most of these are fairly general categories. The one that we do know a fair amount about is carbon dioxide, and I'll focus on that one in today's talk as something that we can track relatively easily and something that's been shown in advance to have some influence on behavior. And so what we did is we measured carbon dioxide production from infected hosts. We put them in small tubes and hooked them up to a respirometer, and we did various treatments looking at different insect species, Galeria melanella and Tenebrio molitor. We could look at them whether they were infected with nematodes, whether they were infected with just the bacteria itself, or whether they were uninfected, either alive or dead, or infected with YS broth, a control for injecting the bacteria. And this is just an example of the type of pattern that we see. Down here we have CO2 levels, and this is microliters produced per minute. And over here we have time after infection going out to 240 hours after infection. These are the infected hosts, and what we see characteristically in the Steiner pneumatids is these two peaks of carbon dioxide production that come off of that infected host. This is a live host, it's relatively stable, and then this is a dead, uninfected host, doesn't really produce much carbon dioxide at all. And then these show the stage distributions within the host, so this is early on in the infection when you have a lot of adults present. And you know, if we were just looking at peaks of CO2 and responding to higher CO2 concentrations, that would match up pretty well to an optimal time for a nematode to infect. However, we also get a peak way out here, which is much later when we wouldn't predict it would necessarily be a good time to infect. And just to show you some summary of a previous graduate student's project, looking at a number of different nematode species in Galeria melanella, and we see the same general pattern, although the specific heights and times of those peaks do vary. In a different host, Tenebrio molitor, we see primarily that first peak, and then it sort of declines. So there's definitely host effects involved with this as well that influence whether they're producing these spikes of CO2. So we looked at host attraction using the standard sort of auger plate with an insect in one treatment and one pipette tip and not in the other, and then releasing nematodes and looking at how they distribute. And we've given them choice between an infected host at different time points or an uninfected host or two blanks treatments. And just to summarize that, when we look at long-range attraction, we see no real difference between the infected and the uninfected hosts, even though there's change in this pattern of carbon dioxide production. So it suggests to us, and this is a similar pattern for all the different species that we looked at, that CO2 may not be involved as a long-range cue in this case. So changes in the level isn't involved in the long-range cue response. However, it may be involved in more close range, perhaps involved in the nematodes finding the spiracles and entering and initiating an infection. So more of those downstream processes may come into play. So we use the sand tube assay that Ed described earlier. We use treatments of no larvae, uninfected, 24, 48, and 72 hours post-infection hosts. And then we added the IJs and then rinsed the sand and counted the IJs that remained and then calculated the number that had entered. What we see in no-choice tests is that the number entering does decline as we go through time, which is what we would predict. These hosts out to 72 hours are declining in their quality as a resource. And if we do, we compare them to the original zero-hour infection levels, all time points afterwards are significantly lower in terms of their infection. If we look at, that was with Galeria melanella. If we look with Tenebrio, we see the same general pattern, a lot more variation, and only the last two time points are significantly different from the zero-hour controls. But it does suggest that there are some cues involved that are changing that are influencing these nematodes' decision to infect. But we would also look at this in a choice bioassay as well, similar to what was laid out before. We set up different levels of time after post-infection, 48, 24, or uninfected, set them up in all the different combinations, and then compare them to sand without the IJs as controls for infection level. And basically what we do is we look at the dissect the host, count the nematodes that are in it, adjust that number by the number that are present in hosts that weren't exposed a second time to IJs, and then using that number as an Abbott's correction, and then we fix the control variation using bootstrapping, and then compare them with paired t-tests. And so we have uninfected here, uninfected 24-hour, 48, and uninfected 24 and 24, two of the same time points, 24 and 48, and 48 and 48. And the only one that was significantly different was here at 24 hours, where we see a significant preference by Steiner-Niemer-Rio Brave for 24-hour infected hosts over uninfected hosts, which is consistent with what Ed was showing as things happening early on. However, once we get further out, there's essentially no difference between them, so they're not really able to discriminate between the other time points in terms of infection, although the trend was to have less infection as you went out. For Tenebrio molitor, again, we see the pattern. There's no graph is set up exactly the same, but here there are no significant differences among any of the different treatments. So in this host, unable to discriminate those two. So I mentioned the bacteria, and what we were interested in seeing was what role the bacteria might play in these sort of factors influencing the preference for hosts at certain time points after infection. So what role is the bacteria? And the nice thing about it is that we can culture bacteria outside the host. We can inject it into the insect alone without the nematodes and then compare similar things that we measured with the complex of the nematode and the bacteria together to see what kind of role it might play. So we isolated primary phase bacteria, injected it, a number of cells estimated from the literature, a rough estimate of how many might be involved in establishing an initial infection. And then we look at bacterial counts at different time points after infection by surface sterilizing the host, homogenizing them, and doing serial dilutions of the homogenate and counting colony forming units. The problem we ran into is that we found a lot of other bacteria in these hosts once we started looking at them. And this is similar to the findings of Isaacson and Webster, that for Steiner-Niemer-Rio Brave and its Xenorhabditis cabellensis, that they've reported that there's a tendency for them to not have a strong suppression of other bacteria species. So this Xenorhabditis species produce antibiotics that suppress the growth of competing bacteria. But in this case, it seems like there are other bacteria that are able to get established. And it tends to be other gram-negative bacteria that are not inhibited. And they can increase and grow at a similar rate to the Xenorhabditis species. So in order to really characterize what was going on inside the host with the bacteria, we had to identify some of these. So we used universal eubacteria primers and PCR to look at trying to identify the non-Xenorhabdus species. And then we used specific primers for Xenorhabdus and then did DNA sequencing and the blast search to look at the match. And so it did confirm that we have Xenorhabdus species in there, and then we had a range of other species, most of which we were able to identify, a number of Enterobacter species, some Staphylococcus species, and some Stenotrophomonas species as well. A number of these are associated with insect gut fauna, and we did surface sterilizations of the IJs and unsurface sterilized and never recovered these species on the IJs themselves. So also if we look at zero hour treatments, we can recover some of the same species. So seems reasonable to hypothesize that these are present in the gut of the insect, or present in the insect, and once the insect is killed, are able to establish and grow. So we measured the growth of the Xenorhabdus species in a Steinermuria bovae infection and in a bacterial injection infection. And essentially in the early stages, they're very similar. We do see some drop off in the number of colony forming units towards the end when nematodes are present, probably because of either nematode feeding or the nematodes also drawing down the amount of nutrients that's available for the bacterial growth. And just to highlight again, the time when we're seeing the significant preference for infected and uninfected is early in this exponential growth phase of the bacteria. So it could be when there was a lot of metabolic activity going on producing the CO2, but it wasn't at the peak of bacterial production. These are the growth curves for the combined non-Xenorhabdus species, and they showed basically the same pattern where they started to drop off some in the nematode-infected ones and to stabilize if the bacteria were present alone. So then we looked at, if we look at these injected hosts and then look at their patterns of carbon dioxide production compared to a natural infection, and what we see here is with Steinermuria bovae infection, which has the nematode and the bacteria, we see these two peaks that we saw in the earlier experiments compared to a YS injected control. And again, we do see a little bit of a spike here, which we didn't see in the uninjected control, probably related to the trauma of injecting the insect. And so we have a mean peak height and a mean time after peak for the combined treatment that is similar to what was shown in the earlier experiments. And if we look at the CO2 production from hosts that just have bacteria injected, we see it's basically very similar to what we see with the nematode, but we don't see the second peak in carbon dioxide production. And it does drop down even lower than the controls after a while. So these levels are very similar to each other. There's no real significant difference in that first peak, but we don't see that second peak. So it may be that it's the bacterial growth that's producing that first peak of carbon dioxide that is timed at the optimal time to infect. And just to compare that to Tenebrio molitor, again, we see a strong first peak and a little bit of a hint of a second peak. And those times and heights of peak are similar to earlier studies. Look at the bacteria alone. We see carbon dioxide production comes in earlier and a little bit higher. And again, in this host, we don't see that second peak either. So there is a significant shift here with the bacteria being present alone in Tenebrio, which wasn't in the other one. And so we went back to our choice experiment to see whether we got the same preference for 24-hour infected over uninfected if we just used bacteria-injected hosts. And I'll just show, basically it was set up with setting up different time points after infection and then a YS-injected control insects. Set them up in all the different combinations as we did before. And then if we look at Xenorhabdus and Galeria melanella, same setup here, the same combinations, but what we don't see is any significant preference for that 24-hour post-infection like we saw with the nematodes being present. So something is missing here, even though we're getting the same carbon dioxide spike and presumably all the other cues that are associated with the bacterial growth. Whatever is involved in those nematodes being able to exhibit that preference isn't there without the nematodes also being present. We did see it a significant difference out here between the 24 and the 48 hours, a little bit of a shift, and we're not quite sure what that might mean. It might be just an artifact. It's certainly not as dramatic as we saw earlier. And then if we look at the Tenebra and Molotar, again, as in the other case, we didn't see any significant difference between the two. So in conclusion, certainly host quality changes during an infection. And while in no-choice tests, IJ infection declines over time, they still did infect even quite far out into the infection process, when presumably that insect is not very not a very high-quality resource. And so that's still an open question as to why they still go into those hosts, even though we don't think they would be very successful. Important influences that are triggering enhanced infection seem to be occurring very early on in that first 24-hour period, as Ed showed in his data and that earlier studies looking at the attraction. We see peaks there up to about 24 hours, and then after that it seems like there's no real preference exhibited. So whatever cues may be driving this, we should be able to detect changes in them in that very early 24-hour phase. So it does help us in narrowing down where we need to specifically look for some of these other cues. And while carbon dioxide does seem to vary quite a bit within infected hosts, and at least some of the peaks may be useful cues, and we know that they do respond to carbon dioxide, and it's important in the host finding and host infection process, it doesn't seem to be explain the infection behavior patterns that we've seen, and that there certainly seems to be other cues involved that we need to identify. And that bacteria plays an important role in that first peak of CO2, but not in the production of the cues that seem to be really critical in driving the IJ infection. So we still need to look for those other cues. And I'll finish by acknowledging some funding from NSF, USDA RAMP program, and I'd be happy to answer a question or two if we still have some time. Right.
How these nematodes are evaluating quality.
Yeah. I guess the short answer is we don't have really good information on that. We do know something about, by looking at the relative difference in numbers, when IJs are going in up until the point where we're getting a lot of reproduction. And then the nematodes are so lost and there's so many individuals that finding ones that are marked that you put in there is very difficult. And we've tried various approaches using various stains and things like that. The problem with a lot of the IJs is that even when they're stained, it's fairly faint, and it's just very difficult to pick them out of all the nematodes that get in there. But that really is the critical thing that we still need to figure out, is what the real costs are and benefits to going in at those different times. So we can by tracking the numbers of individuals and the buildup of toxins and things like that, we can get some rough idea that, you know, this is not really a good resource, but we still do need to do those experiments. And maybe we're overestimating it.
Yeah,
and if we could do a mass thing and maybe do just some quantification of the total amounts of trying to do individuals, we might be able to track that. Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you.